KMO Show, episode number 25, December 1st, 2024.
Hey, everybody. KMO here. And what I have for you today is a conversation with my friend Kevin Lynn. He's somebody I know from my peak oil days. In fact, I first met him when he invited me to come down to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where he lives, where he was putting on an event where he had invited John Michael Greer, James Howard Kunstler, Dmitry Orlov, Chris Martinson, who else? Some other peak oil people to basically put on an event. And I got to interview all those guys in a room. There's a video where I asked them about the potential for shifting from an internal combustion, private ownership-based model of transportation to one where there are fleets of autonomous electric vehicles, and none of them were bullish on that prospect. It's a fun video. I think it's from 2016, which is when I first met Kevin Lynn face-to-face. He'd been listening to my podcast, the Sea Realm podcast, for I don't know how long, but long enough to know that I was associated with that scene, and if he was putting on an event, he'd like to have me there. But since then, we've done quite a bit of work together, and in fact, it was Kevin's organization that paid me to develop the Geb webcomic, and I got to do some traveling in association with that. I went to the EarthX convention in Dallas, Texas twice, and once out to Los Angeles for Politicon 2019. So Kevin was a big Trump supporter, and here is my conversation with him, my first recorded conversation with him, after the 2024 election.
Rolling, KMO.
All right. Hey, Kevin. It is good to see you.
KMO, always a pleasure. It's been too long. How are you doing?
I've been sick. I just took a bunch of cough medicine, so hopefully that'll kick in and I won't be coughing a lot.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That explains. If I do cough.
You sound a little nasally.
Oh, yeah. There's the first cough. Okay. But as you know, I am excited about recent developments in artificial intelligence, and I have invited my favorite chatbot, Claude of Anthropic AI, who knows about you.
Yeah, in fact, I appreciate you because you're the one who introduced me to Claude, and I just kind of use it for grammar, things like that. I haven't gotten as involved in it as you have.
Kind of like using a like an AK-47 to prop the door open.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, exactly.
It can do that. Well, anyway, I invited Claude to introduce our conversation here and to throw out the first question. So I'm going to read Claude's suggestion. Claude writes, "Welcome to the KMO show. Today's guest is Kevin Lynn, a self-described lapsed Republican, unrepentant Perotist, failed Green, frustrated Democrat, and now independent. KMO and Kevin first connected through the peak oil community, where they explored questions of societal complexity and system adaptation. Kevin brings a unique perspective shaped by his varied career from Army officer, serving in the US, Europe, and Asia, to senior positions at major accounting firms, to his current role as executive director of the Institute for Sound Public Policy. Both Kevin and KMO follow the work of Rudyard Lynch, whose analysis of historical crisis patterns suggests we're entering a period of institutional stress more akin to the 30 Years' War than a total war scenario. The 2024 election has produced some remarkable outcomes: Trump's decisive victory, the establishment's failed attempts to prevent it, and the emergence of a new political coalition crossing traditional ideological lines. Yet Lynch's framework suggests this might represent not a resolution, but a stage in a longer process of system reorganization. Kevin, given your experience organizing political groups across multiple states and parties, what do you make of these new coalitions forming around Trump's victory, particularly the involvement of figures like RFK Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard?"
Wow. Actually, I'm... I'm intimidated, to be quite honest, with Claude's prowess when it comes to, one, knowing who I am and being able to put that together so succinctly. And I think it's a great question because, you know, it's funny. I got exposed to Rudyard Lynch. I'm reading right now Peter Wilson's book, The 30 Years War. Mm-hmm. And I really recommend it. I mean, it's a thick tome. It's hard to get through, but it's real. The 30 Years War is amazingly complex. And there are eras of it. It went from, as Rudyard pointed out, from 1618 to 1648. And it absolutely decimated the German Holy Roman Empire states. And everyone was involved. It really was a total war on a continental basis, where you had, at any one time, you had all the principalities in the German states involved. You had the Swedes involved, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, France, and England in a lesser role, more supportive of different players, and Spain, of course, very much involved, and then all these interlocking relationships. But before the 30 Years' War, there were a lot of run-ups to it, and I know Rudyard is probably spot on in many respects when it comes to saying, you know, we should be looking at the 30 Years' War, not necessarily the American Civil War or the American Revolution, for guide stars in looking at what could happen. But I think we even need to go a step back further to the French Counter-Reformation, which took place in the later 16th century. That period between the 1550s and late 1500s. And I think everyone should probably read, if you haven't, I'll pull it down, but become familiar with Montaigne, and because he was very much a player in this period. And I put up a quote of his on my personal X page, and it reads something to the effect of, "The problem with civil war is it makes us all sentinels in our own homes." Because I recall reading a biography on him, and he was talking about there was a point in his life where he was the mayor of a small city, and on weekends he would go horseback riding, ride horseback to his estate. And his fear was to be encountered, he would come on a crossroad, and there'd be Huguenots, Protestants, guarding it. And he was a known Roman Catholic, and they might kill him. And, you know, I have a friend who we're about the same age, and she grew up in Beirut in the 80s during the Civil War there. And she would tell the story. I mean, there's a reason the poor woman has PTSD, highly functioning. But her father would drive her up to a barricade, and she would literally have to dodge snipers on the way to school. And life kind of goes on, as I think Rudyard aptly points out, if not in this podcast, but in another one, where, you know, life just kind of goes on in a civil war. And I think we can find ourselves there. And even though I think if the Trump administration, and I love the fact, I had been saying for 2 years that he needed to reach out and make RFK his running mate. So in, I believe it was August, when he brought RFK on stage with him, and RFK, you know, ended his run for office and his support for the Trump and the Trump campaign. I mean, that was significant. That brought in voters that Trump would not have had. And I know several in California that I knew when I was part of the progressive movement in California and on the executive board of the California Democratic Party. And not a one of them would have been brought in to vote for Trump had it not been for RFK. So I think he might have been responsible for, you know, 1.5, maybe as many as 2 percentage points. And it was a brilliant coalition. I mean, it was an amazing end run around the establishment to do that, and just brilliant. And, you know, one thing about Trump that I had noticed in my one instance where I spent an afternoon with him back in 2020 is that I think he's a really bright guy, but where he's head and shoulders above most people is in EQ, that emotional quotient, that ability to read people in the times and timing. Like Joe Rogan had pointed out, he's a good comedian because he has a good sense of comic timing. And he understands that. So can he evoke the right animal spirits, bringing the right people together? I don't know. Ed Dowd had mentioned recently that, you know, he's inheriting a turd of an economy. And I think Rudyard, in that that 23-minute podcast with Dad Saves America, I think that was it. That was the interviewer.
Yes.
He rightly points out that, you know, politics and feelings aren't why people go to war, you know, do civil war. It's because their backs are literally against the financial wall. And, you know, when you have nothing left to lose, you just lose it. You look at the 30 Years' War, and much of the part of it where it was very much about, you know, it got religious. A lot of the underpinnings of that were economic. I mean, the German states were being just annihilated by the papacy. You know, you had the selling of indulgences, the selling of papal offices, and their ability to escape taxation by the local German, you know, the German principalities. It was bankrupting. And the people, that's, you know, that was a big reason why a lot of people were turning away from the Catholic Church and didn't trust it. And a lot of the reasons for the actual warfare itself. I mean, again, much like today, I don't think people really grasp how hard wage earners have it in America today. You know, I think our mutual friend, John Michael Greer, did an amazing job when he penned an article in January of 2016, because he was talking about why he said at that time, President, you know, Trump will win the presidency in 2016. And he said, he's the only one speaking to class warfare. And that's what's throwing everyone under the bus. And it's systemic. I mean, well, I'll leave it there. But I think Rudyard is spot on that we are on our way to civil war. And the economic underpinnings are there. He was talking about, you know, these inflationary cycles that touched off a lot of the civil wars. Those are here, and we've been able to gloss over it all with financialization, but I don't think we're going to be able to do that for much longer, KMO.
So my Substack is called Gen X Science Fiction and Futurism. I was born in 1968, and I definitely identify with my generational cohort of Gen X. You are a few years older. What is your generational cohort affiliation?
Yeah, I'm technically a boomer, I think. I'm in my 60s, and it's funny. And what I found, and I don't know if you were as amazed by Rudyard as I was, to think that someone so young could possess so much knowledge and have the ability to do critical thinking. Because there's this quote from Henry Ford, and it goes like this. He goes, never trust anything anyone says who's under the age of 40. And unfortunately, boomers, I think there's a huge blind spot with us in that, and I'm fortunate, I have Xers and Zs working for me right now. Actually, millennials and Zs working for me. And they have been able to guide me and help expose my blind spots, and I think help make us more effective. And I don't necessarily want to bring more on, you know, but I want to make sure those people are resourced and doing the things that they feel they need to do, because it's really helping us as an organization to have those insights that someone like myself am pretty much blind to. So it's definitely, there's a generational aspect in there. And I'd be curious, how do you, you know, so I'm saying that's my view in terms of how I think I I'm blinded to what's going on and the damage that's been done. But then again, in my history, I've always advocated for these younger generations. I was an unrepentant Perotist, a Perot supporter, and I worked for the man. He ran for president in 1992. You know, he was fighting these free trade, quote unquote, free trade deals like the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Uruguay rounds of the General Agreement on Taxes and Tariffs, and the World Trade Organization that just wholesale sent millions and millions of good manufacturing jobs overseas, but also wiped out whole towns because there's all these ancillary businesses and concerns that go along with these manufacturing jobs. And they would use this, they would gaslight us by saying, oh, there's jobs, these jobs don't have an economic right to exist. And they keep doing it because they said, learn to code. Well, then they outsourced and offshored all the good coding jobs and everything. You know, they brought in, they heavily abused the H1, although actually it's working the way it's designed to, which is bring in a whole stream of white-collar professional workers to displace the expensive, expendable, and undeserving American white-collar workers who are now competing for jobs at Starbucks and Walmart because they cannot find work in their fields. And I'm curious, too. Well, I also think, again, that's the inflation aspect. But what makes this, I think, exceptionally scary, a moment where we really could lose it all, is there's just for the last 30 years been this lack of, not just, you can see it when you walk outside, the lack of investment in physical infrastructure across the country. You know, China, who when Nixon went over there in the early 70s, you know, the mode of transportation were bicycles. And now they have super fast trains going all over the country and brand new cities. So all that money has been sucked away from the infrastructure of America, but also the lack of investment in human capital. Our schools are an absolute mess. Now, granted, there are great school jurisdictions out there. Like if you go to Los Angeles and you look at LA Unified School District on the whole, it's brilliant. It sucks. I'm sorry. But you go to La Cunada and one other place, and it's a really awesome school district. But for the most part, generally speaking, absolute dog shit. And, you know, I live in the city of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. The public schools here are absolute garbage in terms of producing people that are highly competitive and need to be competitive in the 21st century. And we've been let down largely because of the influence of, you know, those organizations that have a vested interest in maintaining power and not giving it up. And lack of investment in the trades. You know, you can't keep technicians or find a good plumber, a good mechanic, tradesmen, you know, in construction, because, you know, the unions weren't investing in that next generation coming up. So I think all these combined to really put these younger generations at their backs are against the wall, and the wage earners who don't have access to health care and things like that are particularly vulnerable. And the reason Trump was able to garner so much vote and enthusiasm. I mean, did you go to any of his rallies, KMO?
I have never been to a Trump rally.
Well worth going, because it's almost a religious experience. I mean, one, you're around great people, I thought. And people were genuinely excited. They travel miles to be there. Even if he spoke for just an hour, you know, they'd wait in line. Like here in the city of Lancaster, when he spoke here, a buddy of mine was getting off a night shift. And he was going to come over and just hang out, crash here. We'd go down at about 11 because Trump would be speaking at 5. And we wait till they open the doors at 2. And he'd just gone down to look it out. At 9:30 a.m., I got a call and says, look, I'm in line because people are lined up. 9:30 a.m. to hear him speak at 5. I mean, that tells you just, and it's not like they think of him as a god, because Trump voters, you know, they booed him, you know, when he spoke about the vax, the jab and everything. They're very opposed to that. They're not like brainwashed or anything, but they realize that, you know, they might have just one opportunity to get back in the saddle, and it's Trump. And, you know, they came out and supported him for that. Does that help answer, kind of set the
Oh, I mean, you answered several questions I didn't ask, but that's all right. I ask about the generational cohort thing because I know that you are familiar with the framework laid out by Strauss and Howe and their right. generational theory. And, you know, the phrase the fourth turning means something to you. And I just wonder how much in the forefront of your thinking, you know, that timeline is, in terms of we are coming into a period of intense crisis. And on the other side will be, you know, the new spring, the new awakening, new good times. But we have a really rough period to get through before we get there.
Yeah, I think everyone should be familiar with the concept. I first got, you know, we're looking at generational issues. When I was at this small military college called Kemper in Missouri, there was an old woman, Ruthie Roberts, who taught accounting and economics. And she had been there since shortly after World War II. And she loved her boys. And, you know, she taught about a Russian economist. His name was Kondratiev. And he had come up with this principle that, look, when you look at innovation, the economics, it's almost like it's the life of a long-lived human being, like roughly 75 years. And then you had people like Harry Dent who came along and, you know, applied prices and markets to that, where you could say, look, I can tell you when a generation will buy the most potato chips. And he would also say, look, you know, the Great Depression was caused when the Henry Ford generation began to retire and they stopped buying the cars, the college educations. And so that started the Great Depression. And then when the Bob Hope generation went through a similar thing, you know, the 70s, we had a serious recession. And he had predicted a couple things early, and which is why I, you know, became an adherent of his. He had said that this in the 80s, you might recall, there were all these books like Japan is number one. You know, the Japanese were eating our lunch in terms of, you know, building better products, selling on a global basis. And the fear was, you know, they would be number one, America number two. And, you know, but he predicted they were going to fall off a demographic cliff and that the U.S. is going to go through this resurgence in the 90s. And that's exactly how it all played out. And he predicted right around 2008, when a critical mass of boomers would start to retire and pull in. And that's pretty much, we had, you know, the Great Recession of 2008. And the Great Financial Recession or something like that, GFR, I think. And, you know, people like me in 2006, we kind of saw it coming. And for me, I got out of equities. I got back into doing commercial property tax, which is where you wanted to be when the commercial real estate market tanked. It's a good way to make money. But so the and then Strauss and Howe came along and they put these political templates over this generational thing. And they took that period of a long-lived human being and cut it into four sections that they call turnings: first, second, third, and fourth. And that fourth turning is the dangerous one. You know, you go back 80, 85 years, where are we? We're at, you know, in economic stagnation, world on the precipice of total war. go back 80, 85 years before that, the American Civil War. 80, 85 years before that, the American Revolution. And, you know, Wars of Spanish Succession. So I think there's something to this. And the question is, is being forewarned enabling you to be forearmed? Or are these forces so great? You know, and that's where I'm hoping the Trump administration, given their overall openness to new ideas and, you know, bringing in cabinet members that aren't all of them, you know, the quite the status quo establishment types, younger, you know, they might be able to seize the moment and, you know, apply some of this knowledge and say, wait a minute, it's time to back off, because, you know, you can't talk nuclear war in a fourth turning because someone is going to pop a nuke and it could be bad for all of us. It could lead to actual total war. Now is the time to be prudent and hold back. So that's what I'm kind of hoping to see. And that's the importance, I think, of, you know, a book like The Fourth Turning and that concept of how, you know, generations kind of work in certain program modes and how we might be able to avoid pitfalls that might accompany that.
Well, speaking of Rudyard Lynch, he does reference The Fourth Turning quite a bit in his videos and his interviews and things. He also talks about the Clio dynamics of Peter Turchin, which is a very data intensive, basically historical analysis and model for projecting or forecasting. And Peter Turchin's models also have this decade as being one of great turmoil, followed by a new prosperity. I also follow the work of geopolitical analyst George Friedman, who, you know, he wrote a book.
I read his The Next 70 Years.
He's got a lot of books with similar titles, but his most recent one, what's it called?
Do you recall he had a consulting firm in the 90s?
Stratfor,
that's it, yes, yep. Yes.
Well, anyway, his model basically, it's not so much a model that is as refined as, say, Peter Turchin's, but he is also, you know, via this data analysis and historical analysis, predicting the 2020s are going to be a time of great turmoil as well. But again, followed by, you know, a new period of, I guess, nationalistic esprit de corps, you know, which sounds, if you say nationalistic for half the people listening, you know, that's just equivalent to Nazi. But, right. You know, a people living in a place with a shared history, a shared language, a shared perspective, feeling solidarity with one another and cooperating in a way that, you know, more disparate collections of people cannot cooperate and find common ground. And that is a recipe for prosperity.
Yeah. Oh, and absolutely. You know, another mutual friend of ours, James Howard Kunstler, would speak a lot to that. You know, when you know, if you have the hard times coming, you kind of want everyone operating in the same framework, this, you know, shared values. You know, the problem with, and which is why I focus so much on immigration, is, you know, when my mother came here in 1952, immigration was restrictive, well-regulated, and it was somewhat rare. And everyone won. Immigrants weren't being exploited. They weren't endangering, you know, the productive classes here in the U.S. as they had been prior to 1924, when it was pretty much unbridled. But you add to this where we have had so much immigration, where we don't have these shared values, and, you know, where maybe someone is thinking, all right, I got to do what's best for the country, but, you know, and I'm applying something of a soldier's loyalty to one's country, as opposed to kind of a merchant point of view, where it's like, okay, what's in this for me? And then if you add to the fact that, well, if things go sour here in America, I can always return to my old country of origin. And, you know, these are big problems, because these hard times really are going to require us to work together. And if we don't have that sense of community, like I was speaking to an immigrant who was working checkout in a grocery store I was at over the weekend, or this weekend, actually, yesterday. And he was trying to talk his wife into moving to Germany because he said, wow, you know, we don't know anyone here. No one seems to, it's hard to get around. You got to work all the time. And, you know, it's time for us to maybe move back to, you know, we want to go to another country as opposed to the one where they were from. And that just means, again, culturally, you know, a lot of new arrivals are simply outside, you know, social networks that could be mobilized to bring the country together. And, you know, and then you add to what's been going on the last 4 years, KMO, this absolute invasion through the southern border, where we might have added as many as 10 million, 11 million people, and many of them of military age. None of them with any set loyalty or aspiration to be loyal or fit in culturally in this country. And we have a real recipe for danger. And you add the hard economic times are coming. We could, you know, I'm sure in 1854, you had people that kind of were open to the notion that we could be approaching civil war, but I think most of the country probably thought, ah, no way. You know, yes, we have big issues. There's problems in Kansas, and there's a group that wants to end slavery. There's a group that wants to keep it at all costs, and no one really probably thought we were actually going to get into an amazingly bloody conflagration that was the American Civil War. And that could be the issue here, because to me, you know, again, going back to Claude had mentioned my experience as a military officer, but in the mid to late 80s, I was, for instance, at one point, the Supreme Allied Commander Europe's terrorism analyst, hunted groups like Abu Nidal, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, and read everything I could on insurgency and counterinsurgency. And that part of me is telling me we could see a big preoccupation in America going forward in the hard time. If we end up in very hard economic times, pretty much fighting a counterinsurgency here as well, because we could very well have operatives in the country that don't have America's best interests. In fact, are malevolent forces here. I think if, let's just say, since we brought in people from 152 countries over the last 4 years, let's just say you're running clandestine ops for a small third world country government, and you're thinking, how can I damage America? And we don't have any resources. Well, I can get 10 guys that we've trained, get them to go through the southern border, and then get them to set up shop in America and have them be sleeper cells until they are told to come and, you know, do damage, like things like maybe blow up a railroad bridge, blow up a water treatment plant, things like this, things that could seriously irritate us and force us to devote a lot of resources to something we ought not to be doing. There was no need to even contemplate doing before the Biden administration.
You do, you have a lot more to do with X, formerly Twitter, than I do. Yes. I have an account there, but I basically just post links to my Substack pieces. But I do want to go over to Substack here. I'm going to read just a little bit from the Kucinich Report. This is Dennis Kucinich's Substack account.
Okay.
And Dennis Kucinich writes, "Our government is planning a big draft, conscripting millions of young Americans for an even bigger war. I call your attention to a Democratic amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act, which was slipped into the almost $1 trillion Pentagon war spending bill by voice vote in the House Armed Services Committee. The Democratic amendments to H.R. 8070, the National Defense Authorization Act, reads, Section 531, Selective Service System, Automatic Registration, Section 3, except as otherwise provided in this title, every male citizen of the United States and other male person residing in the United States between the ages of 18 and 26 shall be automatically registered under this act by the director of the Selective Service System. So I'll stop reading there and just say, you know, when I turned 18, I went to the post office and I registered for the draft.
Okay.
This new methodology eliminates that. Everybody is being registered for the draft automatically. And Dennis Kucinich paints this as, you know, the establishment preparing for war.
Yeah, I mean, this establishment doesn't care about human life. We are a commodity. I mean, look at the Ukraine war. Over a million Ukraine deaths, probably easily 500,000 more Russian deaths. And for what? To launder a lot of money? They just don't care about us. Now, interesting thing about Dennis Kucinich, talk about, again, this new politico environment that's being created. So I was attending CPAC last year. No, it was early, very early this year. Right. It was early in 2024. And it's a Friday night. I'm at the bar with some friends. And I look, and in walks Elizabeth and Dennis Kucinich. Okay. Dennis Kucinich, the founder of Progressive Democrats of America. And, you know, at that time I was, you know, Howard Dean had formed Democracy for America. They were both, had both run the 2004 presidential race as progressives. We call big P progressives, not what to be confused with goes for progressive today. And I was actually running as a volunteer the Pasadena Democracy for America chapter. So I would come in contact with the progressive Dems of Los Angeles a lot, a Kucinich group. And I'd met Elizabeth once at a e-board meeting of the Democratic Party. And I'm like, what are you guys doing here? I'm like, what are you doing here? We're here, we're at the Republican, you know, this is the big CPAC, the big, you know, right-wing conservative event. And, you know, Dennis at the time was running as an independent in his old congressional district. Sadly, didn't get it. But, you know, his views are very much that of RFK, Donald Trump right now, America First. What's great about Dennis is that he's really seen the light on immigration, but he was always against NAFTA, GATT, WTO, all of these trade arrangements that put America last. Unfortunately, he didn't win that run as an independent. The Dem who was running for re-election was able to maintain his seat against a Republican challenger in Dennis Kucinich. But that kind of, it's funny you brought Dennis Kucinich up because he is typical now of what's happening with people that I think are not necessarily concerned about being a, you know, a progressive or a liberal or a conservative or a Republican or Democrat. You know, they're finding, like I am, their way in this political culture to where we can push a more America First agenda. So, but yeah, that's really interesting. And again, I think it speaks to the fact that there isn't that, you know, again, the expectation is that young men themselves would not go down to the post office and register. It's going to happen to you. It's almost like you've gone from the masculine to the feminine when it goes to war.
Well, I could pursue that rabbit, but it would involve talking about somebody who has not agreed to be talked about and who is not necessarily a public figure, but I'm referencing a recent conversation. There's a guy named Steve Krakauer who does not publish to Substack often, but I read his most recent piece today, and he was talking about the election, and he pointed out that, you know, Kamala Harris, who was not selected via a Democratic primary process, but who was just appointed to, you know, be Biden's successor, that she not only accepted the endorsement of Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney, but really leaned into it hard, took Liz Cheney on the campaign trail with her, while Donald Trump has surrounded himself with Democrats or former Democrats, you know, who have left a sinking ship, you know, most notably Tulsi Gabbard and RFK. You know, Trump himself is a former Democrat. I imagine that Elon Musk, while maybe not particularly political, you know, prior to the last, say, 5 or 10 years, would have been a Democrat, you know, if he cared at all. But Krakauer's point was that the Cheneys are definitely the establishment. And people like, you know, Tulsi Gabbard and Robert Kennedy Jr., they are, you know, sort of fringe characters, and they do not read as establishment. You know, you could make an argument that they have establishment ties, but to the electorate, they read as anti-establishment. And this election showed that people are just done with the establishment. You know, they are not interested except in a few, you know, little blue holdout regions. But if you look at the electoral map, that's just not much of the country.
So I'll let you take it from there. Not physically much of the country. It's the large civic centers. And you would think, too, that has to be slipping because, you know, I live an hour and a half drive from Philadelphia. And I mean, it's a city with a lot of problems run by Democrats. Even in my small city that's run by Democrats, it's, you know, I see the beginnings of the same shakedown that happened in San Francisco, where, you know, where 20 years ago, the budget was one fifth of what it is today. And they had not nearly the issues of homelessness and so many other things, but they pump all this money into their NGO, this NGO community of friends who are able to get out the vote for them and keep them in office. And unfortunately, and no NGO exists to work itself out of business. So all the issues that these NGOs are, you know, supposedly, ostensibly trying to fix, they have no ultimate interest in actual fixing.
Yeah, the first priority for any organization is to perpetuate itself.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, an interesting
funny,
thing.
Even in my situation, in August 3rd, 2020, we met with President Trump, you know, to very specifically keep 200 information technology jobs at the Tennessee Valley Authority from being offshored. Initially outsourced to H-1B visa dependent companies like Capgemini, and then eventually offshore to low rent countries. President Trump fired the chairman and one of the directors who hired the CEO of TVA. The CEO rescinded his decision to outsource those jobs. It was a big victory. Now you would think that if you're a small organization like ours, punching way above their dollar weight, I mean, it was great. Even the Jacobin was like, why are these guys saving union jobs and not us? And you would think that that would have led to a lot more sources of grants and donations from people that, you know, were down with our movement. It led to just the opposite. One very large funder divorced himself completely from us. You know,
because he'd met with Trump.
Yeah, he had Trump. I personally had Trump derangement syndrome really bad. But regardless, like I try to make the case, it doesn't matter. You said, look, you know, you support us because we are mitigating the impact of unbridled immigration and helping working American men and women. We scored the biggest victory in 40 years on this front. And and I just found funding cut across the board. So it gets back. Is there truth to this, that ultimately at the end of the day, no one wants to see, if you're involved in this NGO complex, I call it the NGO industrial complex, you want to see your bread and butter being taken away from you. It's, and you kind of, you can look at what happened with gay marriage. You know, a lot of people like me that didn't necessarily support it became supportive of it. But no one shut down shop. All these organizations went on to the next thing. It's like, okay, now we need to make, if you're gay, or they increased the scope to LGBTQ and the whole, you know, alphabet soup of things, to include transgenderism. And then it's like, oh no, we need privilege over you guys because we were this class that was ostracized. And, you know, now that, you know, now we need to come back and get way back, not just back to good, not to good, but we need privilege. So it never seems to stop. They never, no one, you know, I would love KMO right now to, you know, say mission accomplished, turn the key in the door for the last time and shut this operation down because we had won. But I think most people, again, who are in, as you mentioned, in this NGO nonprofit world, don't see it that way.
You know, you've mentioned several of our mutual acquaintances over the course of this conversation. There's another one I'd like to bring in, and he is a very active presence on Substack, and that is Steve Lamb. Who is Steve Lamb?
All right, Steve Lamb and I became really good friends when I was living in Pasadena, California initially. Then I moved up to Altadena, where Steve was a town councilman. He's not an architect, but he does building design. So he's not like a licensed architect, but he does a lot of, you know, work in that area. And he was a town councilman of a sleepy little town called Altadena in California for 24 years. And when I had taken over Pasadena Democracy for America, I'd mentioned Howard Dean, and you know, he created from Dean for America became Democracy for America. And the Pasadena chapter eventually came, according to Howard Dean's brother Jim, the most effective organization west of the Mississippi for them. But early on, I had said, okay, we're going to do a visioning meeting, bring all the activists together and say, okay, where are we going, you know, with this organization? And it was where it was going, you know, Steve was up talking and he's saying, look, we got to push out these corporate Dems. We got to get back to grassroots activism where we're responding to the needs of the people, not just the people, but things that actually make good economic sense here in the community, get rid of all these NGOs that have latched on to, you know, and we had, there were a number of them, even, you know, religious ones that had just kind of latched on to the Democratic Party and were running things. And we were all Democrats and progressive Democrats. So during one of the breaks, some of the old establishment guys in the Pasadena area were there. And, you know, they looked like on me, like I was the bright, shining young star that was gonna, you know, they would just like, what do you want? You know, here's your path forward in the Democratic Party. And they were like, Kevin, you got to get rid of that guy. And they're referring to Steve Lamb. You got to get him out of here. What he's saying, that's an abomination and he's got to go. Get rid of him, Kev. And I'm like, gentlemen, that's where we're going. And if you don't like it, you can go. And so that began Steve Lamb and my collaboration years ago. So Steve has always been kind of a Mustang, you know, out there in California politics and fifth generation Californian. So, you know, when you've been around for generations, you know, there's a lot that just comes down verbally from prior generations to you that you know about things. And, you know, a lot of things that happen that governments do at the local, county, state level, you know, you can apply a sniff test to it and go, no, that doesn't make sense. You know, I know how it happened. I know where some of the bodies are buried kind of thing.
Well, how would you describe Steve Lamb's political orientation, say, 10 years ago?
10 years ago, I know exactly where it was. I'll give you a great example. So when our Pasadena Democracy for America had come into real prominence, I mean, we were a political power in the San Gabriel Valley as a totally volunteer organization, but even Republicans would come to us looking for our endorsement because they're like, we know you guys, you have a reputation of being, you know, pretty fair, and you know, you're pretty upfront with where you want to accomplish, and you know, will you at least let me speak to your group, you know? And so that was kind of the orientation. So we were, and I know Steve was, you know, understood that the Democratic Party, certainly in California, were a bunch of corrupt apparatchiks. And it was a bunch of people that would just glom on and use it to do what they want to do. And they would just gaslight anyone who would say anything different. So that's kind of where he was 10 years ago.
And where is he now?
Good question. Where is he now? Well, right now, he's now the chairman of my organization. Because he had come on several years ago to help us out on our board. And I would say he's, you know, he really is kind of an America first mindset, who is, you know, understands where a lot of the corruption is, whether it's MK Ultra, you know, looking at, you know, a lot of these conspiracy theories. He's actually done a lot of study on the assassination of Robert Kennedy, you know, RFK's father. And so, yeah, I mean, that's kind of where I see him today.
Well, he is a vociferous Trump supporter. And, you know, he posted 2, 3, 4 times a week sometimes, you know, long, very eloquent and erudite essays, basically talking about why, you know, the regardless of Trump's faults, the Democratic Party establishment was simply unendurable, unacceptable. You know, it had to be defeated and deposed. I mention this because, you know, like you, I mean, you are a former Democrat, and Trump is surrounded by former Democrats, but people who have been pushed out, like, you know, Bernie Sanders in 2016, he ran a left-leaning populist campaign, and the Democratic establishment moved heaven and earth to smear him and marginalize him, you know, call him a sexist and a racist and, you know, all the usual stuff. And, you know, basically burned half of their own field, you know, in order to keep the populace down. And that's just driven so many people out. So now, you know, the electoral results basically, you know, demonstrate the country is not having it. You know, the majority of the population.
All right, so that was most of the conversation with Kevin Lynn. I am going to save not the last half, more like the last quarter, for the paying audience on the Cibrom Vault podcast and behind the paywall on Substack. All right, thanks so much for listening. I will talk to you again. Stay well.